It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer Kent. When Wisconsin residents hit hard times, some turn to local welfare offices for help. Those offices are outsourced to private for-profit companies where staff often preach the power of work, sometimes place people into unpaid work experience, and enforce work requirements in the name of teaching self-sufficiency. It's a multi-million dollar industry, and a new investigation is raising questions about who benefits the most. Call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chrissy Clark is the host and senior correspondent of the documentary podcast The Uncertain Hour. The most recent investigation, the Welfare to Work Industrial Complex, focuses on work requirements for cash benefits and who profits in Wisconsin and nationally. Chrissy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Your latest investigation examined the relationship between work requirements, cash benefits, and profits in Wisconsin. So explain cash benefits in Wisconsin and what the work requirements are to receive them.
Yeah, so in Wisconsin, welfare or cash assistance is known as W-2 or Wisconsin Works. And just to step back for a minute, so across the country and in Wisconsin, the idea of work requirements in welfare, they're not necessarily really about having a paying job, even though a lot of the rhetoric around welfare reform is about the power of employment to lift people out of poverty. Most of the laws governing how work requirements work, they're not actually about employment. The only real metric that states are actually held accountable for around their use of welfare dollars is something called this work participation rate. And that's the sort of wonky mouthful of a term that basically means it measures how many people are receiving cash welfare or are doing some sort of work activity for a required number of hours. So a paying job will qualify, but if you don't have one of those yet, in Wisconsin, you're assigned to up to about 40 hours of these other work-related activities. So searching for jobs, taking motivational job readiness classes, or as you mentioned, doing unpaid work experience at a local nonprofit or for-profit business. There's also in limited amount of hours you can do in education, getting your GED or short-term vocational education training classes. And then you have to document each hour of work activity that you do with logs and timesheets in order to get your check. And if a state doesn't meet their target work participation rate, they can actually lose some of their federal funding. So what that means is that there's a lot of energy at the case level where case managers are focused on whether each individual participant on welfare is complying with the amount of hours that they've been assigned. Some people I've talked to who work in these programs have described it as sort of a compliance paperwork chasing machine. A lot of time is spent doing paperwork and data entry to make sure that participants are doing their required number of work activities. And if you don't meet the number of work activities you're supposed to be doing, you get $5 docked from your check for every hour that you don't participate in an assigned work activity. So that's kind of how it works at the broad level. And the issue is that there is not a lot of evidence that these work activities actually do much in terms of helping people get family sustaining jobs, which is the whole point of this. For a lot of people, it kind of feels like busy work, sort of more like a paperwork requirement than a work requirement. Some people do get a lot of, some people, you know, find benefits from it, but overall, there's not a lot of evidence showing that these programs are, these so-called welfare to work programs, are actually getting folks into family sustaining jobs that would allow them to not have to turn to welfare in the future.
Can you give me some examples of, where work requirements end up being problematic for some of these, some of the people that you spoke to? I mean, are they getting training in things that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise?
Yeah. So, you know, let me tell you about one woman that I followed for this story, this woman named Darnetta. So she had actually turned to welfare after fleeing domestic violence, had some very traumatic events. She had two kids. And so she had had to leave her house in a sort of in a frantic moment. So she really just, she needed help. She didn't have anywhere else to turn at that point. She did have some, a fair amount of work experience, a pretty solid resume. She had college credits. She was close to finishing her associate's degree. She had, she'd had jobs before. She had clear goals. She wanted to be either an addiction counselor or open up her own restaurant. She says she wanted to work. She turned to welfare both for the immediate cash assistance, but also to sort of help. She had heard this is all about welfare to work, and she wanted some help in achieving her goals towards landing back on her feet and getting a job. When she brought her resume to her caseworker, what she was told is that she would be, her assigned work activity was going to be packing and stacking boxes in a food bank for up to 40 hours a week. And when she, and actually, if you did the math, she was going to be making about $653 check. That's a typical check in Wisconsin.
For a month.
Monthly
for a,
check.
Okay.
Yeah, for a month. So mm-hmm. not a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
She, when you do that math, kind of divide the amount of work hours she was going to be doing into that check, that's making essentially about $4 an hour, less than minimum wage. So when she was told this is what she was going to be doing, she felt like, wait a minute, this is not, like, this is manual labor that is, like, I'm working towards my college degree. This, how is this going to help me in landing a job that is actually going to pay me a amount of money that allows me to support my family? She actually pushed back and asked for another job, and she was assigned office work instead. But she kept kind of, this was one of the first signs for her that maybe this was not a program that was going to be helping her get the kind of job that she needed. The work, she kept bumping into these sort of these constrictions around the work requirement program. If she was late to a work activity, if she didn't fill out a job log correctly, she would get sanctioned. She would get $5 per hour that she missed taken out of her check. Often she was getting like $20 to $100 taken out of her check, or maybe even $200 in a month. And when you're only getting $653, mm-hmm. that's not a lot. And what she found, meanwhile, she was, as I mentioned, she was sort of recovering from a series of domestic violence incidences. She was trying to go to therapy appointments and bring her family back together in the aftermath of this. And then that was kind of bumping up against these pretty, the structure of the hours she was supposed to be at these various classes and work requirement assigned activities. So for her, that became a real problem. She felt like the program as it was set up wasn't helping her and was actually becoming kind of a stumbling block for her as she was trying to get her life back together.
We're talking about the privatization of the welfare state with Chrissy Clark. She's the host and senior correspondent of the documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour. The most recent investigation focuses on work requirements for cash benefits in Wisconsin and who profits, both in Wisconsin and nationally. You spent years touring for-profit welfare offices, including in one in Milwaukee. Let's hear from that for-profit welfare company in Milwaukee now.
Look yourself in the eye. And with excitement and enthusiasm, say, I love my job because they pay me for working there.
So what is the atmosphere like in the for-profit offices, and how much money are they making for job readiness programs?
Yeah, you know, until I started this reporting, I did not realize that there was such a thing as these for-profit companies that were running welfare offices across Wisconsin and in places all over the country. And to be clear, there are also in Wisconsin some nonprofit companies that run some of the regional welfare offices. But for example, in Milwaukee, I think it's 3 out of the 4 offices are run by for-profit companies. The one that I visited was run by a very large company called Maximus, which is actually a multinational, multi-billion-dollar publicly traded corporation based out of Virginia. And, you know, you go to the office, it's typical cubicles, fluorescent lighting, but a lot of motivational posters on the walls mm-hmm. about the power of work, as you heard, a lot of these motivational speeches. And the main focus in these offices is this idea of welfare to work, getting people into jobs and off of welfare. And so one of the first things that you might do when you apply for welfare and get enrolled is be assigned to take one of these motivational classes that the company offers for several hours a day. And you write down your goals and your dreams and learn how to maybe dress for a job, the importance of punctuality, learn about interviewing. And some folks I talked to, you know, they learned from these classes. They were helpful. But a lot of folks had already had jobs. The problem wasn't that they didn't know how to get a job or that they weren't motivated to get a job. The problem was often that the jobs did not pay enough to allow them to create any sort of safety net so that when for themselves, a personal safety net, so that when they hit hard times, they had the wherewithal mm-hmm. to make it through. And then when I talked to one of the designers of this class at Maximus, who's also a VP there, it was clear that sort of aside from the motivation, there was this other thing that was driving these programs. Because one of the things that the company does is they cultivate relationships with area businesses and then help sort of funnel and connect people to jobs in the area. These are often entry-level jobs, service jobs, warehouse work, sometimes in fast food. And what is important to understand about how this works is that for every job that one of these, a company like Maximus connects somebody on their welfare rolls with a job that lasts more than 31 days, as long as that job makes at least $800 and lasts for 31 days, the company gets a payment that's called a performance outcome payment. Mm-hmm. And it's often like $1,000 to $2,000. And
so that's how they make money
by they're covered sort of just for the administration and enforcement of okay. work requirements, the monitoring, the case management, but the crucial part in terms of their profit are these performance outcome payments. And the question is, is getting somebody a job that might make them $800 a month, that's all it takes to qualify to get one of these payments, and that only lasts a month, is that actually setting them on a path to self-sufficiency and financial stability?
Chrissy
and it's
Clark,
not clear that it is.
Okay. Chrissy Clark is the host. We'll pick that up in just a minute. Chrissy Clark is the host and senior correspondent of Marketplace's The Uncertain Hour. She stays with us. You can call 2-800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. Politicians for decades have debated whether people on the receiving end of entitlement programs should be required to work, look for work, or participate in job training programs as a condition for government aid.
Look for a job, get a job, all of that.
Should be required to work.
An obligation to work.
Looking for a job, have a job, or be participating in a job training program.
It's time for all Americans to get off of welfare and get back to work. You're going to love it.
That's in the introduction of a new podcast from Marketplace. So what are your thoughts on welfare reform proposals? Call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chrissy Clark is the host and senior correspondent of the documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour. She investigated work requirements for cash benefits and who profits in Wisconsin and nationally. She stays with us. Chrissy, something that you said a few minutes ago just keeps sticking with me. The amount of money that a for-profit agency gets for placing someone, it sounds like they're getting more money than the worker is getting.
It can, when you do the math, it can add up to that, or it can work out to that sometimes. For example, so Maximus, the company we were talking about earlier, there are several companies that have similar models. Maximus, AmericaWorks, Equus. But to take Maximus as an example, according to our analysis of state records, in the last 10 years, the state of Wisconsin has paid Maximus over about $7 million based on the kinds of performance outcome payments that I was talking about for people on welfare getting jobs and retaining those jobs for up to 3 months. And I actually looked at, sort of dove into one case in particular, this woman, Quanessa, who lives in Milwaukee. She turned to welfare soon after her second child was born. She didn't have stable housing. And she went through a Maximus welfare to work program. And, you know, she says that she got some things out of it. She felt more comfortable interviewing, and she ended up getting she did some of this unpaid work experience as a cleaning offices in a nonprofit. And she ended up getting a job as a custodian through a company that Maximus had connected her with. She ended up making about $13 to $14 an hour to begin with at that job. This was a few years ago. But when I dug into the story, you know, a couple things came out. One, it became clear that she'd actually already been doing cleaning work and had several jobs as a cleaner before she went through this welfare to work program. So it was a little unclear how much help Maximus's welfare to work program had given her versus whether she might have gotten that kind of job on her own. The other thing is, as you mentioned, if you compare the amount of money that Quanessa got through cash welfare in that time, it looks like, and then you compare the amount of money that Maximus got for connecting her with these jobs over, she cycled back onto welfare. She got off welfare through this job as a custodian, but then it turns out that job wasn't paying her enough that she could afford a car that worked very well. So when her car stopped working, she had to leave that job. And transportation is a huge issue for a lot of folks in terms of being able to get to where a job is. So then she went back on welfare. Maximus connected her with another job that also didn't pay a whole lot. And so she ended up having to work two jobs to make ends meet. So if you look at all of the rewards that this for-profit company got for connecting her with these various jobs, they made about as much money from the state and likely more if you do the math compared to the amount of cash assistance that Quanessa was getting in that time. And so that, you know, kind of raises these questions, especially given that the kinds of jobs Quanessa was getting weren't necessarily setting her up for success. They weren't paying her a whole lot. She was working really hard, but I think there's sort of this question of all this money that's going to incentivize these companies to get people into the workforce. Are they doing what we want them to do? Especially if a lot of folks already have had some job history and are ending up in these very low-paying jobs.
We're talking about the privatization of the welfare state with Chrissy Clark. She is host and senior correspondent of the documentary podcast The Uncertain Hour. The most recent investigation focuses on work requirements for cash benefits and who profits in Wisconsin and nationally. A couple minutes left. We will go to Mary Kay in Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning. I was in the very first program in Kenosha. We had that here. It's a never-ending program of constantly going to programs. The assessors aren't in. They're never in. They're only in on certain days. You get sanctioned if your papers aren't signed. They go on vacation. So you're constantly going around in circles. The very first problem with the program is the jobs don't pay enough to live. You need at least $30,000 a year now to raise a family, okay? A part-time job is not really a job. It's part-time, okay? And there's no monitors for these programs. If we had monitors that would actually talk with the companies about transportation and childcare, because that's the real reason people can't get jobs. They can't get there. When those employers want you, they want you now, not when you want to go.
Thanks, Mary Kay. Yeah, and what do these companies do to help with transportation? Is there any of that component involved in the process?
Yeah, you know, there are transportation vouchers and some transportation assistance that the companies connect people with funding that comes from the state or from these federal block grants for welfare. So there is some assistance that is offered, but I think that the experience that Mary Kay is referencing is quite common. And as I mentioned, this woman, Quanessa, you know, once you get off the once you sort of graduate out of the program and you have a job, if it isn't a job, if it's only paying you, I think the average wage for jobs that welfare participants, people on cash welfare, W-2, got in Wisconsin was about $11 an hour. So that's not enough, you know, that's not enough money to support a family on, let alone an individual. So transportation does become a real issue. One thing I did want to point out is that I spoke extensively to folks at the state about some of the issues, and they were very candid about the fact that they know that a lot of these programs are often connecting people with low-paying work. They know that that's an issue. They know that people are then sometimes cycling back onto welfare because when they hit another stumbling block, they don't have the financial safety net to mm-hmm. not turn to it. And they've actually entered into a contract to have the program evaluated that's going on right now that they are hoping to be completed before the next contract start in 2025. So there is some awareness at the level of the state administration that maybe, you know, this program that's been around now since 1996, it hasn't had a formal look in terms of sure. sort of what could be done. And I think that there are efforts to start to reevaluate that.
Thank you so much. Chrissy Clark, the host and senior correspondent of the documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour. The most recent investigation focuses on work requirements for cash benefits and who profits. We have a link to The Uncertain Hour at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Idea Network.